Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Let's give a warm Dallas-Fort Worth welcome to the Beardsons. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That was a very generous introduction. Maybe I should start by saying a little bit about how I came to write this book, and then say what the book's about and how I've dealt with the topic, and then go on and spend some time just talking about some of the issues in front of China through the 21st century. As Jim said, I've lived in Hong Kong for 35 years. I started an investment bank in 1984, which became the first foreign investment bank to be licensed to operate inside China in 1989, and nobody else came along for about 4 years. So nobody was very interested in China in the 80s and 90s. We were the only foreign institution to take part in the working group to set up the Shanghai Stock Exchange in 1990. These were all very interesting times for China. There was a lot happening. In the 80s and 90s, China was the fastest reforming country in the world. It changed hugely and very much for the better. So it's been a great privilege to have followed China from the 70s, just after Mao died, right through to today. It's a distinctly different country now. What the book's about is really, we've had so much literature and so much discussion about China's rise, how dramatic it's been, 10% a year growth for 30 years really transforms a place. And we can argue whether it was 10% or 8%. I mean, I think the data are very questionable, but the reality is that China has improved hugely. It's clearly grown a lot. What I thought that I'd like to do in the book is to say, so what's going to happen from now? Is China, as the literature mostly suggests, going to become eventually the global superpower? Is it eventually going to take the role that America had and be the sole dominating superpower in the world? And my answer is no, it won't. And I look at all the challenges that China is facing through the century, both those that have arisen now and those that will arise later. So it's a fairly multidisciplinary book. It actually looks at everything from education to morality, to the language, to economics, finance, politics, the environment, technology, social trends, demography. I think it's probably the only book in the English language I've seen which takes an integrated approach to where China's going to go. So maybe what I should do now is talk about some of the challenges that I see coming towards China. And for me, the biggest challenge is that of demography. And the unfortunate thing about that is that it's not a soluble challenge. There's nothing really that can be done about it. We can have palliatives, we can improve things at the edges, but we can't fundamentally change that challenge. There are other challenges that are really important, really difficult situations, which can be changed. I see demography as being essentially an insoluble challenge. It comes in four forms, but the first one is the labor force. For many years, China had an abundant and growing labor force because its births were rising every year. But from the 1970s till now, we've had a 40% fall in the annual birth rate, and that's now coming through to the labor force. There are fewer people every year joining the labor force, and that's causing wages to start rising, and they're now rising at double-digit rates every year. That undermines the previous successful economic model of China, which is to be the low-cost manufacturing country to the world, where it was cheaper to make almost everything you can think of. Now that's no longer the case. People are now looking for other places to manufacture. So China has to change its model. It's got to become a more innovative society. It's got to become a knowledge-based economy. Unfortunately, there's very little sign of that happening. So that's the first challenge that's coming from demographic change. The second is that China is an aging society. There are over 100 million people above 65 in China today, but by 2040 it's going to be over 300 million. And you could say that's all right, because culturally Chinese people have always looked after their old people. They take them in, they look after them. But the difficulty is that we're now seeing families where not any of the parents are alive, but the grandparents are alive. So an adult Chinese might have six of the older generation in his family alive, and so might his wife. So when you've got 12 people and you've got no siblings, you can't just say, well, come and use the spare room. You've got a problem, and institutionally, at the moment, only 1.5% of elderly people in China are in any kind of government care homes. So you've got 1 million in care. When you get to 300 million in 2040, you're probably looking at a third to a half of those being in institutional care, maybe 100 to 150 million. So you've got a huge increase in government cost. The budgetary impact of the aging society in China is huge. And all the on-costs of healthcare changes, because people might be living longer, but they're not necessarily always well. And for a lot of people in China, a visit to the hospital costs a year's income. This is not a welfare society. The third challenge that China has is gender disparity. We've had, in the last 20 years, 6 boys born for every 5 girls. That's because people tend to prefer to have boys rather than girls, and they get what they want. But the implication of that is, over the next 20 years, we're going to have 40 or 50 million men who are not going to have a wife. And that doesn't mean 1 in 6 men won't get a wife. What it means is that women tend to have choices. Women tend to marry upwards. So they tend to marry men who have some more money, or who are more intelligent or better looking. So what it means is that maybe 1 in 2 men who are poorer, stupider, uglier, are not going to get a wife. These guys are going to be in the cities, they're going to be angry. And it's already showing up in crime statistics in Chinese cities today, but it's going to get a lot worse. It's a recipe for instability, and there's simply nothing that can be done. These people are all born, you know what the ratios are, it's not going to change. So there's quite a lot of instability on the way for China through this. And instability, as we know, is really bad for the economy. The fourth thing is that by 2020, China's population will get overtaken by that of India to become the largest, most populous country in the world. And that has a lot of effects. And one effect is that now every multinational company has a China strategy. Well, then they'll all want to have an India strategy as well. And that will mean some diversion of capital flows that the moment might go to China, likely to be going to India. But what it does mean is that soon after that, China's overall population is going to peak at maybe around about 1.4 billion and start to come down. And there are lots of different forecasts about where it's going to come down to. But by 2100, the most cautious forecast is that China will have lost a third of its population. The more aggressive forecasts are anywhere up to two-thirds of the population. So you're going to have somewhere between 900 million Chinese and maybe down to 500 million Chinese by 2100. So at the moment you've got 4-1 Chinese to Americans. It could be down to 1.1, 1.2. So a very different relationship. We won't be looking at scale and what are they up to next. Technology will become more important. Scale will be less important. But looking even beyond that, I think it's correct to say that no society in human history has been able to have a sharply falling population and sustained high economic growth rates. So by the 2030s, we should be looking to China to be a low-growth economy, something more like Europe. So China now, with its 7 or 8%, may be able to have some financial ability to deal with issues, but it's going to have a lot less ability by the 2030s. And I would argue that having been a very reforming country in the 80s and 90s, by the year 2000 it pretty much stopped reforming. The political price of reform became too difficult, too many vested interests were being disturbed, and reform was basically put in a cupboard. Now, China really has to start reforming again to deal with the challenges that are soluble while it can still afford to do it. Because if it delays another 10 or 20 years, the opportunity to deal with challenges will not really be there. So, in my view, there's an urgent need for China to gear up and start reforming, and there's not a lot of sign of it doing that. The sort of challenges that are soluble but are important are things like a dysfunctional financial system, an education system that doesn't allow the economy to become innovative, a devastated ecological environment. If I just talk about the financial system for a moment, for a lot of people who feel that having $3.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves somehow makes China a strong country. And I think that's because people don't ask the question very often, how do you actually create foreign exchange reserves? The two main methods that China has to create foreign exchange reserves, one is that its companies export more than they import, so they accumulate foreign exchange, but then they have to sell that foreign exchange at the end of the year to the central bank. The central bank buys it from them for local currency. The other way is that China intervenes in the foreign exchange markets to keep its currency down by selling its currency and buying foreign currency. So it ends up with $3.5 trillion of reserves, but it costed almost $3 trillion of its own money to get those foreign exchange reserves. And it didn't start with $3 trillion worth of its own currency, so it's had to borrow it. How does it do that? It asks all the banks in the banking system in China to put 20% of their balance sheet as reserves with the central bank, so it borrows the money. It issues bonds domestically in local currency, so it borrows the money. One of the problems is that the income it gets on US treasuries is rather lower than the interest it pays on all the debt. So there's an estimated loss on the interest rates every year of $66 billion. But of course, there's a huge risk if you are borrowing $3 trillion of your currency to acquire $3 trillion of somebody else's currency. You really hope your currency doesn't go up. I don't think that China's position makes it a very strong country in the world. What it does, it makes it a very vulnerable country. You could say that to be 80-90% geared, to have all your assets virtually in one basket, something you don't control, is perhaps one of the most highly leveraged hedge fund operations in the world. So I would question a lot of the commentary about China's position. And another example, of course, is that in 1980, the private sector in China was 3% of the Chinese economy. It's now about 2/3 of the Chinese economy. So if you think the Chinese economy grew at 10% a year, and let's say something like that was probably true, then the private sector grew at 20% a year. But why is it that 70% of bank loans go to the state sector? So the credit isn't going where the growth is. So that's a problem. The system's dysfunctional. Also, you look at the Chinese stock market. A lot of people overseas have said, well, this economy is growing at 10% a year. How can we get into this economy? How can we invest? Why don't we buy some Chinese shares? And they get disappointed with things like the fact that last week the Chinese stock market closed at the same level it closed at in 2001, 12 years ago. There is simply no relationship between the Chinese stock market and the Chinese economy. And the reason for it is pretty clear. 86% of the companies on the Chinese stock market are state enterprises. What's growing in China is the private sector. So when you buy the Chinese stock market, you don't buy the Chinese economy. So all of this is dysfunctional. You could even ask the question, if the private sector had access to the capital markets, if it had access to bank credit, it might have grown at more than 20% a year the last 30 years. So what would China have done? So I would argue that there's a lot of reform that's needed in the financial system of China. This is not a strong system. It's dysfunctional and it's vulnerable to external shocks. Another area that might be worth talking about briefly is China's move to become a knowledge-based economy. Why isn't it becoming innovative? And a lot of this comes down to Chinese education. The focus in Chinese education is on rote learning. It's, if you do the university entrance examination, you get to question 27, there is an answer. Have you learnt it or haven't you learnt it? They're not looking for critical thinking. They're looking for people who have learnt the answers to all the questions. So you get a certain kind of mind in the secondary system and the university system in China. And this is not the kind of thinking that's conducive to producing an innovative economy. And it's a reason why China does not have one university in the top 100 in the world. A lot of people in America are very frightened of the success of Chinese research and development, Chinese technology, Chinese science. I would suggest that people could be a little bit at ease here. It really isn't that impressive. There are patches of excellence. I mean, some of the space technology, some of the supercomputers, maybe the new 3D printing. In a number of areas, China has excellence, but overall, the picture is poor, it's weak, it's not innovative. There's a lot of plagiarism in Chinese science. There's a lot of deference to hierarchy, which is not the way we see science working. If you're an older person, a more senior person, you're reckoned to be the better scientist. We don't look at it in that sort of way. China's now decided that having patents is a really good sign that it's doing well. And China's acquiring a lot of patents every year. But so often these patents are incremental. They're just an additional process on something that's already been invented by somebody. the quality of patents is not impressive. China puts a lot of attention on research and development expenditure. They have targets. What percentage of GDP can we get our research and development up to? But of course, so much depends on what you spend the money on, and also who is spending the money. They will say that 70% of the R&D expenditure in China is by business, which sounds good, sounds rather like America. But then you actually look at what that means, is most of it is state enterprises, and these are not driven by profit motive. They're not responding to market signals. They're often doing projects that government has asked them to do, which are not commercial for them. So it's not enough to look at the easy data, but to try and understand behind the data what's really happening. 83% of the high technology exports from China are made by foreign companies. And even then, you've got to look at what is actually done in China. If you look at an iPhone, the internal parts have come from Korea or from Germany or from Japan or Taiwan. They go to China and some guy puts them in a cardboard box and wraps them in cellophane. And priced at $150, it comes to America and it's sold at $300. Well, the work that was done in China was probably rewarded with $4 or $5 US. But it counts as a big export item to the United States. But actually the money that's made for the Chinese economy is very little. The companies that are doing the assembly are often Taiwanese companies, so the profits going to Taiwan. And who's actually benefiting from these high technology exports? People are really taking advantage of low cost in certain areas in China to do things, but the Chinese technological base is not gaining from this kind of work. And we're just not seeing the advance of technology in China. So we have to be very cautious about saying that China is a rising giant in science or technology. On any surveys of innovation, Chinese companies very rarely feature. If you look at things like branding, one or two surveys will put maybe five Chinese companies in the top 100. But when you look at the methodology for the surveys, it'll often in some way be related to revenue. And of course, if you're in an oligopolistic position in your home market, competition's not allowed. There are three mobile phone companies or four oil companies. You've got a pretty guaranteed profitability. But just being big in a controlled market doesn't make you a global brand. So the methodology is often wrong in the surveys that we read. And maybe if I touch on the environment as just being another issue, China has the worst environment of any major economy in the world, whether it's the pollution of the soil, the pollution of the water, the air, or the food chain, where food safety is really atrociously negligent. Just taking water alone, there has been so much wasteful use of water that the aquifers under major cities are largely empty. We're getting a huge expansion of subsidence. You've got sensors and monitors at Beijing Airport or in the subway or on the high-speed rail tracks in case the ground gives way. The pricing of water has been so poorly and unmarket-driven. The largest use of water in China is in agriculture, and 55% of the water in agriculture doesn't get to the point of use. It's just lost on the way. And as a result, because China militarily controls the Tibetan Plateau, it's now looking at diverting some of those rivers that rise on the Tibetan Plateau. But those rivers are like the Indus that goes to Pakistan, the Ob, which goes through Russia, the Mekong, the Brahmaputra, some of the biggest rivers in the world. And if China diverts that water increasingly to North China, which is the largest piece of water-short land in the world, it's going to have a lot of angry neighbors who are used to that water. So we're seeing the potential for conflict rising from the inefficiencies of the use of resources within China because of the lack of market pricing, the culture of waste, and I think rather than diverting water from other people, it might be better to improve the system within the country. But that's not part of the culture at the moment. There's even been talk of using nuclear weapons to blow holes in the Himalayas to get the water out. There seems to be a preference for large engineering projects over cost control, waste management. But in all these fields, China has huge challenges which are costing it a big proportion of its economy, which could otherwise be productively used. We've got illness in China. I mean, in the coal mining area of Shaanxi province, 30% of all children are born with birth defects. In Yunnan province, I think something like 18% of the children have lead poisoning because of the indiscriminate use of industrial pollution. So China really needs to put some of these things right, or it'll have a less and less stable environment. People will get more and more angry. There'll be more and more of these mass riots. And at some time, of course, it starts to threaten the economy and the ability of business to function. So those are some of the challenges I see, but China has many, many others. So I try and talk about these in the book. But the main message is, I think, that the one thing they simply can't put right is demography, and there's very little sign that they're putting the other things right. So at the moment, there's this sense of stasis in China, that, yeah, we recognize the problems, but they're so difficult to deal with. And things are just floating. And I don't believe that China has the ability to continue floating. So I think that China has to make the decision to reform early, deeply, and radically, or else it's simply going to have no prospect of continuing its rise through this century. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have a tradition here at the World Affairs Council, and one I suspect that the Crow is happy with, and that is to give students the first question. And this is from Leland Cook at Corsicana High School. How alarmed is the United States government, and maybe we should say should the United States government be, with the hacking conducted by the Chinese government, and what countermeasures are being taken?
Well, there's been a lot of publicity about Chinese hacking, and I think that China possibly is the most advanced technologically in this particular field, another area where they are doing quite well. And of course, we have to recognize that virtually every government in the world is doing some kind of cyber espionage. It's not just China, it's not just Russia, it's not just Israel. It's actually lots of countries that are doing it. We can't really say it's not acceptable that you do cyber espionage. We've probably got to try and work out where the lines ought to be. And I used to think that perhaps the line is that everybody is stealing information from everybody else. I mean, France is stealing from its partners in Europe. I mean, everybody's stealing something. But maybe the line ought to be when you go and cause damage and you close down people's systems, then maybe you've stepped over the line. Maybe we can make some distinction. And then along comes Stuxnet, and it's widely believed that America and Israel use that to damage equipment in Iran. And of course, it didn't just damage Iran, it damaged a lot of neutral countries' equipment as well. So it's difficult to know where the lines are that we should be drawing. Can we have some kind of Geneva Convention in which we say you don't try and close down an electricity grid because you'll close down hospitals and people are going to die? We haven't really got anywhere. We haven't had any success at getting a convention as to what's acceptable and what isn't. But I think China's probably technically the most successful and advanced in a field where everybody is a player. I think we have to acknowledge that.
questions. Mr. Schaefer.
How would you distinguish between, as China moves from a labor-based economy to a knowledge-based economy, can you distinguish cyber espionage from a standpoint of attacking national institutions from China's alleged growing disrespect for intellectual property and its effort to, if the reports are correct, steal industrial secrets from private corporations, which it then manufactures and exports?
Well, yes, intellectual property is an interesting subject because, of course, we don't like the theft of intellectual property. But then I look back to the 19th century, and that's how America built its economy, on the theft of European intellectual property. If you look at the way copyright laws developed here, they deliberately were held back so that as much as possible knowledge could be acquired for a new and growing economy. And that was kind of understandable, because there were different interests, people who had something and people who didn't have something. And now the field looks different. I'm a bit reluctant to get too heavy-handed about taking intellectual property, but of course, if you've got it, you don't want it stolen. And when we look at R&D in China today, we have to recognize that probably 15% of all the R&D in China is being conducted by foreign multinationals. And when you look at the amount of money that's spent on research in China, and you realize that foreign companies naturally don't want their IP to be stolen, you can't assume that R&D in China is somehow going to benefit the research and scientific community in China. It's for the benefit of those who are investing in it. So a lot of these numbers mean very little. I think we're probably living in a different world where now most people want to protect IP. Even Chinese companies are coming around to it. And there have been law cases in the United States where Chinese companies have sued foreign companies for theft of their IP. So I think we are seeing interesting changes. And I think that things are getting better for the protection of intellectual property. But China is naturally, as a country that's deficient in IP, trying to level the playing field. So the Ministry of Railways will say, OK, we will buy Siemens railway train technology, providing you actually build these things in China in a joint venture with a Chinese company. Then, of course, 3 years later, that Chinese company is offering the Siemens technology in Brazil. We know that's going to happen, but we just have to hope that we keep one step ahead of the game the whole time, and we can afford to lose our old technology because we're continually making new technology. And that's the bet that a lot of companies are making. Otherwise, China is going to try really hard not to buy your technology. So all these things are happening. But I think most of the leading companies in the world are not happy, but are reasonably confident that they can keep innovating. And China's always running behind the game the whole time.
Michael?
Can you speak a little bit to how access to natural resources around the world is going to affect China's growth?
Well, China has this sort of post-socialist idea that mercantilism is the way to go. They don't trust markets. They want to rather own the energy in the ground. They want to own food. And they're losing cropland in China. They're trying to acquire land overseas. But I have this feeling that if we're going to get the sort of forecast food crises in the world over the next few decades that some people suggest, and that's what the Chinese are trying to protect against, that if you've got 100,000 acres in Zambia and you're producing maize to ship to your people, if there's a global food crisis, I'm not sure how easily you'll get that food out of Zambia. I just think a lot of these contracts, a lot of these investments that China's making will end up being nugatory. I don't think they'll actually work out the way China thinks.
Let's take two more questions. Yes, sir. We may need the microphone over there if you'll wait for the microphone.
I know you're an expert on China, but you mentioned India. And India is a rising economic power. They have different problems than China does. Can you just maybe talk about India in relation to what you're talking about?
In many ways, they're the opposite of each other. But are having rather similar results. I mean, They're both currently finding it difficult to get the level of growth they'd like. In India, it's almost an abundance of electoral choice, but the national government may favour reforms, but then the provincial governments may not favour reforms. It's difficult to get things done in India. Also, I think there's been a little bit of reform fatigue in government, that it's become harder and harder for the Indians to push reforms through. It was looking quite good 5 or 6 years ago, looking less good now. Of course, what China really doesn't want to see is a country like India that has an electoral process delivering 8 or 9% annual growth. I mean, because that's a rebuke to the argument that you can't have a developing country with an open political society. So it's very interesting to watch whether India can deliver or not. At the moment, I think that they've got a lot of difficulty in getting things done.
Right, last question.
Yes, okay. For the residents in China, how is their media portraying the outside world? As some of these issues do come to fruition, are they going to point the finger at the outside world as the source of the issues? Or do you think they'll be open and allow immigration freely to help resolve some of these issues?
That's almost two questions, I think. And on immigration, I think one of America's fundamental advantages is that your demography is positive, and you're going to have more people here at the end of this century than you have today, maybe 500 million against 320 million. That's a favorable economic background. But of course, the reason is because of continuing immigration. And you have maybe 34 million people today who are immigrants. Maybe half of those are here to provide labor, and maybe half are here to provide talent or expertise, and that's a huge number. China has 600,000 foreign people working there. China's not gaining anything from foreign immigration, and it shows up in the culture, in the science, in the society, in the economy. So the situation of the two countries is very, very different, and it's partly push and partly pull. Chinese don't particularly encourage immigration, and on the other hand, people who could go there are not choosing to go there. I mean, if Beijing were going to be the next New York, the next London, the next ancient Rome, the centre of a world power, you'd see all the top poets, intellectuals, scientists, cooks going to Beijing. But they're not. No one who has a choice is moving to Beijing. So China isn't doing anything to make itself the new talent centre of the world. I've forgotten your first question.
Well, how the media portrays the outside world.
But it's difficult to generalise about the Chinese media, because although virtually all of it is state-owned, apart from the internet, journalists take a lot of licence, and they get away with a lot of things. So there's an awful lot of material in the Chinese government media which is critical of China and the Chinese government. It's carefully written, but it is very critical. How do they write about the rest of the world? Often quite hostile, often quite nationalistic, because you've got to reckon with an education system where the school history books are extremely one-sided, very xenophobically presented, and children grow up thinking that the world has been pretty awful to China throughout most of history. There's very little about what China's done wrongly over history. Chinese historians have made the observation that there's probably less than 5% truth in a school history book. So against that background, it's quite difficult, because the pressure is on the government to stand up for China, stand up against America, stand up against Taiwan, or whoever is this week's villain. I think the government's really got to take it on itself to re-look at what it teaches children in schools. That would be one way to defuse potential conflicts, which you can see already coming down the road at us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beardson.
Pleasure.
Thank you
very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.